Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 23rd of April. For a long time now, we've been asking the question, whatever happened to the $700 billion taxpayer dollars that we gave to the TARP Fund? Where has that money gone? And nobody's been able to provide much of an answer, so we have the expert for you this hour of the program, who I hope will be able to shed light on the answer to that question. Professor Christopher Mayer is with us, Senior Vice Dean and Paul Milstein Professor of Real Estate at Columbia Business School, Research Director of the Paul Milstein Center for Real Estate, visiting scholar at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. He's been active in advising policymakers on the current financial crisis, has testified before the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate on the use of TARP funds and also how to reduce foreclosures. So he really has a good handle, expertise on the whole housing crisis in this country as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm sure there will be many this hour. Call us as early as you'd like, and we'll get to you early today. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Should you be sending an email, then you can do that. And here's the address. It's talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Professor Mayer, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Finally, we got the guy. We've been asking the question so long. What the heck happened to the $700 billion, Professor Mayer?
Well, that was the same question we were asking on the campaign trail and continue to ask. Actually, we sort of have a pretty good idea where the money has gone. More than $200 million, probably close to $300 million at this point, has actually gone into the banking system. And a lot of this money has shored up banks. Most of the banks wanted it, and a few of the banks didn't, and were given it anyway. That's sort of in the larger money center banks. Another almost $200 billion has gone to smaller banks who requested TARP money, some of whom are now trying to return the money. And the remainder of that is either left over or the Obama administration has committed about $75 billion of that money to help reduce foreclosures, although very little of that, actually none of that has been spent so far, but it's committed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still, depending on the accounting, and they come out with different accounting every day, there may be as much as $100 or $150 billion left. But, you know, again, it's a little hard to, you know, the exact accounting of that is still a challenge to figure out.
And what has it done for us?
Well, I think the biggest thing is, had we not injected a couple hundred billion in the money center banks in the fall of this year, we would have seen some of those banks collapse in all likelihood. And whether or not we think that the banks are lending more money than they would, than, you know, they did last year, they, in some cases, those banks wouldn't have been around to lend any money at all. So the single biggest thing that TARP money has done has kept alive some banks to make it through to this year. The rest of it, I think, the second sort of benefit has been just some amount of confidence in the financial markets that the banking system, you know, more broadly isn't collapsing, not only just specific names, but some of the smaller institutions as well. So that's, I think, the principal thing we've gotten for our money. I do not think that the way TARP has sort of gone through all these different iterations of how people have been selling it. I think it has been a program that has been very poorly explained to the public and has been a program even the Obama administration has kind of struggled to think about, you know, what they're doing with it.
Right. And I'm wondering, maybe there hasn't been enough public outcry about this. Please tell us where our money went. But why isn't it more fully explained? I don't think most of us have a clue where this has gone.
I think it's just a very complicated kind of program. And the difficulty is it has been explained, but then they change it, and they change it again. And so every time they explain it, you know, the government explains what it is, it's as of that moment. But then the program changes a month later, and what was explained last time doesn't anymore make sense. You know, it was originally a program to buy toxic assets. And then we discovered that that wasn't going to be so easy to auction off the toxic assets. Then we just decided, hey, we're going to dump several hundred billion dollars into the banks. And then we did that, and then we sort of got past the election after we did it. And then we started doing these other programs, TALF, PPIP. All these things have different names. I'm not even sure, you know, frankly, I don't think most economists even understand the difference between these programs. Forget about whether your listeners would have any chance of it.
Right. One of the other problems we've heard is that they haven't been lending money to small businesses, to people who want homes, and that was one of the purposes, and they just have fallen short here. Is that true, or is money more available?
Well, it depends on what, you know, economists would sort of call the counterfactual. That is, what would have happened absent the program. Lending, by most measures, is down this year compared to last year. So if one wants to say the principal thing of the program was to grow lending, it has not succeeded at that. I think that's too ambitious a goal because the market conditions right now, as we know, unemployment is rising, firms are having a lot of trouble, just demand for borrowing has also fallen. So what we've seen is lending has fallen, the TARP money is sort of sitting in banks, and banks are holding it, for the most part, to build up their capital. And so it has not succeeded as much as people would like at increasing the availability of credit. I think small businesses is a good place to talk about housing. The only housing credit available is through the federal government, through Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA. If you want to buy a home and you're not getting funded from one of those places, you are going to just pay incredibly high rates. You know, if you're a so-called jumbo loan, more than $720,000, you know, your rates are going to just be exorbitantly high.
Right.
So the banks are not in the business of making mortgages at the moment. The banks are trying to get real estate off their books. And, you know, credit cards, they're obviously raising fees. There's a hearing on that today. It's, you know, it's not a very pretty situation.
No. And how can they be raising fees? This is just unbelievable. Even people, you keep hearing story after story, who have been really good on their credit are getting their credit cards going up to, you know, 20%, 25%. They're aghast.
Well, I could tell you what the banks say the reason is. I can't tell you whether that's appropriate or not, but you know what the banks are saying is that we're in a recession, unemployment is rising, more people are going to be losing their jobs, and somebody who has an outstanding balance on their credit cards is riskier than they were before.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the other thing, which is very unfortunate, but is, you know, banks have become more sophisticated about credit cards. So, for example, if you live in a zip code where house prices have fallen a lot, statistically, you're more likely to default on your credit card even if you've never missed a payment.
Oh, my.
And so the bank, you know, the credit card issuers have gone through using models like this and decided, well, we're going to raise rates because on average, people living in your zip code are going to default more. And you know, that's a really challenging thing. You know, the analogy would probably be you have a 16-year-old who gets a car and starts driving. You're a really responsible parent, and you don't let the kid drive with any of their friends. You don't let them drive at night. You put some monitoring device on the car. That 16-year-old is much less likely than average to get into an accident, but the insurance company doesn't know that. They just know that it's a 16-year-old, and they charge him the rate of other 16-year-olds.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening with credit cards, is if you fit into a bucket that's a higher likelihood of default, even if you personally aren't, you're paying higher fees for it.
So you've got the average taxpayer paying a huge amount of money in the TARP program. Then you've got the average taxpayer, many of them paying more money to help these banks through higher credit cards. This is a double whammy.
Well, it is. So the TARP money is a little bit different for taxpayers. This is one place where the TARP money is supposed to be structured as loans. The way this was originally created, although it was supposed to be $700 billion committed, it was not supposed to cost $700 billion because the government was buying assets that had value. so that they would get something back.
Right.
So the net cost wasn't supposed to be anything like $700 billion. In fact, when people originally sold it, we were supposed to earn a profit as taxpayers. That clearly isn't anywhere close to happening. A lot of the stock we bought in banks is now worth a lot less than we as taxpayers paid for it. But one of the sort of really crucial things, and I think that this issue with bonuses has just been a disaster from a public, you know, from a public perspective, is that almost everyone in the economy, from consumers to businesses, even large businesses, rely critically on the banks to survive. And, you know, as bad as it would be if we were to lose one of the three, as we may well, automakers, if we were to lose a large bank and they were to shut their doors, you would literally have millions of people who rely on that bank for credit who would be completely cut off. You would have large numbers of businesses who would shut down, and the economy would really, it would just be a catastrophe. And so banks play a special role in the economy because they serve to provide credit for people elsewhere. And because they have that special role, history says that if you let your banking system collapse without doing anything, you also let the economy collapse as a whole. And that's the reason that we are putting money into the banks, is we really need the banking system. Unfortunately, we also need the banking system to behave responsibly, and that's where the whole issue of, you know, how much we're paying executives, bonuses, et cetera, has, you know, really come into play.
Right. Well, today I want us to put our money to saving newspapers or our democracy will collapse.
You know, the newspapers, I will say one thing, which is, and I'm not an expert on the newspaper industry, but I do have colleagues at Columbia who are not as pessimistic as the headlines about newspapers, that generally sort of think newspapers are going to survive. We're going to have a vibrant media business. They're just not going to survive in the same form they did before. And news is just going to take a lot more, you know, there are just many more ways people get their news today.
Right. So this loan then, let's just look at the ability of these banks to be able to pay back this money. It's not going as it should, you said. Will it at some point?
Frankly and unfortunately, I think there are many, many more problems in the banking system than we have let on. And if there's sort of a disappointment that I have with the administration so far, it has been that we seem to be trying to paper over the losses by the banks and take a little bit of a view of, well, we're going to hope that the economy is on the right path and we'll sort of earn our way out of this. And we're not going to force the banks to sort of realize the losses they have in their system, which in some cases would require more government money going in. But the alternative, as we know from Japan, is, you know, a lost decade, which is 10 years of no growth. And that alternative is a pretty terrible alternative for Americans and for the economy. And so I've been disappointed so far, and, you know, I'm holding off a little bit of a view because the stress tests haven't really come back, and so Secretary Geithner will have an opportunity to be more aggressive about this. But historically, kind of pretending that the banking system is fine when it's not has been a recipe for disaster.
Professor Christopher Mayer is our guest. We finally, I think, found somebody who can explain this pretty fully, and even I can understand this. Professor Christopher Mayer is Senior Vice Dean and Paul Milstein Professor of Real Estate at Columbia Business School, Research Director of the Paul Milstein Center for Real Estate, Visiting Scholar at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and he has testified before the House and the Senate on the use of TARP funds and how to reduce foreclosures. We'll also ask him more about those stress tests. Remind me to ask him about those. And we'll look at the housing crisis. Yesterday's news, of course, that the crisis has kept us from being able to move. So the idea of relocating for better opportunities is down to its lowest level since the Census Bureau started tracking this back in 1948. We'll ask his response to that and to the whole housing crisis, too. Here's our number. Join the conversation right now, if you'd like. 800-486-8655. 855-800-486-8655 is our number. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Thursday, the author of Early Spring, An Ecologist and Her Children Wake to a Warming World. It's a beautiful book and alarming. So that's coming up, hour number two. Professor Christopher Mayer is with us this hour. Our number again is 800-486-8655, or the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, and we'll start taking your calls momentarily. You mentioned stress tests. I don't understand them. What's a stress test?
My guess is that the banks look forward to these as much as any cardiac patient looks forward to going to see their cardiologist.
They're not fun. I've been there.
You know, the best news you can get is that things are okay and it just goes downhill from there. You know, what is a stress test? Well, literally, it is a bunch of examiners going into the bank and saying, all right, well, what loans do you have? And do these loans look like they're really good? I'll give you an example of the kind of thing a stress test is supposed to pick up. You may have read an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. There are four banks, or there are four buildings going up in Atlanta, Georgia, new office buildings within a mile of each other. Those buildings are going to be finished very shortly, but most of them are vacant. There aren't going to be any tenants in them. And, you know, there are banks who have loans on those buildings that may well, let's say you're a bank and you lent $150 million to for one of those buildings. You might keep it on your books at $150 million, but an examiner would look and say, well, you know what? Those buildings aren't going to be occupied, and that borrower is going to default on that loan. You may only be able to sell that building eventually for $50 million. And therefore, that $150 million loan is actually a loss of $100 million. That's the kind of thing that, even though the loan looks like it's current, the asset underlying the loan is no good. And if a bank were not properly marking their assets for what's going to happen, then the bank is really misleading how much its loans are worth and therefore how much capital it has. So what a stress test does is really tries to go through and look at all of the assets that a bank has. An asset is a loan or something else of value, and really tries to make sure that the assets are worth what the bank says they're worth. The problem is there's several areas where we think the banks, you know, outsiders certainly do. The IMF recently reported they think there could be as much as $1 trillion of additional losses not yet taken in the U.S. banking system. Is that people believe areas like commercial real estate, credit cards, and even mortgages, home mortgages, have not been marked down to what they're eventually going to be worth to the banking system. The Goldman Sachs report says banks are carrying mortgages on average at about 91 cents on the dollar on their books, home mortgages. But with all of the defaults and foreclosures and, you know, other problems that still are growing in the housing market, there's probably a realistic expectation that those mortgages on average are not going to generate 91 cents on the dollar. They're going to generate less. And that's the problem. The idea of a stress test is you're supposed to go in and say, you know what, you don't have assets that are worth what you think, and therefore we may, you know, we're going to have to take some action to stabilize the bank. Unfortunately, that action typically involves government money, but that's what a stress test is supposed to do.
Okay. Let's go to calls. Nancy from Milwaukee is our first caller. Professor, hi, Nancy.
Hello. I wanted to tell your guest that here in Milwaukee, the local newspaper is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and in yesterday's paper, buried on page 5, was a fairly large article about the fact that the very companies that have received all of these bailouts have already spent $10 million to lobby lawmakers in Congress so that they will ally themselves with the banks rather than voting for any kind of a deal that would relieve the bank of the need to pay their their employees these magnificent bonuses. In other words, the lobbyists are trying to already persuade, and using our taxpayer money, $10 million of it, the need to not provide, to be able to have, continue to have all their secrecy, to be able to pay their corporate officers anything that they want to, including the bonuses. Now, I am very, first of all, I'm very upset that the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel put this on page 5, because more people need to be aware of this. It should be reprinted in red ink on page 1. But instead, the local paper is in financial stress, as many newspapers are, and so they put a lot of Hollywood and sports stuff on the front page in order to sell the newspaper.
It's another whole issue.
It bothers me terribly. I am so angry about the fact that this.
Well, the one thing I'm sympathetic to the newspaper is that anything about TARP is not likely to generate a lot of readers. But as you say, the content of this is quite important. Let me respond to this, and I will respond in a way that is not going to be, I'm not going to quite respond in the way that you might like, but I'll try and at least give you some rationale. The first is just that everything the banks spend money on isn't sort of taxpayer money. The bulk of money that, you know, it's really hard to separate one from the other, and that's a big challenge. But banks always do lobbying, as do other organizations. Certainly the auto companies and, you know, everybody else lobbies. I'm not saying that it's right or wrong. It's just our political system. The issue of bonuses is a challenging issue, and I'll just sort of, you know, I will make an argument that, you know, the people who got us into this trouble, the CEOs of the banks who really did the worst stuff, are more or less gone. Not all of them, but pretty close to all of them. And the organizations and the areas that have been in trouble are no longer there. The risk we have if we don't allow the banks to hire people who are really experienced finance professionals to run them is that those finance professionals will go into kind of the shadow system, which is they will leave the banks and they will go somewhere else where they can earn more money. And the problem is the people who are sitting there now in management, for the most part, are not the people who caused the problems. But if you tell somebody that you're going to be on the front page of the paper and your salary and your address are, which is really what happened with AIG, and again, I don't defend AIG, what they did was wrong, no doubt, because they paid the bad people money. That is the people who made the mistakes. But we can't have a banking system if we require all of the employees to have their salaries and, you know, everything plastered on the paper, because people will show up in their front lawn and they'll just quit. And we really need talented people in these organizations who are going to try and save them. That does not mean paying $10 million bonuses. But it does mean that compensation for some of these people is going to be more than $500,000, because they do have alternatives, and they will go to those alternatives.
What are those alternatives?
Well, the New York Times had a very interesting article on the front page, I think it was about a week ago. People are setting up their own organizations, whether they're investment banking organizations, advisory firms, in many cases money managers, because today, you know, the government is looking, you know, in the PPIP program and other things, they're looking to private capital. And that private capital is coming from hedge funds, investment management organizations who don't have these legacy losses. And these individuals will go to those places to work. And they can do good things in those places. Some of them are very talented people. And while it is a lot of, $500,000 is an enormous amount of money,
yes,
compared to people who are struggling, for some of these people, they do have alternatives. And it's not just the money, it's the publishing. You know, the names come out, people, protesters show up on their lawn, no one's going to work in that environment. Mm-hmm. So there is a middle ground here that we need to get to. But I do think that we are just not going to get participation in government programs. And if we don't, it's just going to be, you know, it's really bad news when banks are flooding to give back TARP money, even though we know that they have more losses to come.
Thanks, Nancy, for your call. We go to Matt from Janesville next. Hi, Matt.
Hi, yes. The guest mentioned something about ignoring the problems in the banking sector is could lead to catastrophe. And I just wanted to get his comment on the idea that we may have been ignoring the problems in the banking sector for over a century, and that is that a fractional reserve system, fiat currency, money not backed by gold, and government forcing the interest rates much lower than the market would otherwise set them, is just not a system that's sustainable for long term in the economy.
I guess I would sort of say I think the issue of a gold standard is probably more complicated than where we want to go with things today, but you know, I think there is a viable system along the lines of what we've been doing with a, you know, with a Federal Reserve or, you know, some monetary authority that will work pretty well and has worked overall. I don't think that's the biggest cause of our problems at the moment. So I guess I think there is, certainly our system is nowhere near perfect, but I'm not sure that everything kind of dates back to having gone off the gold standard, at least, you know, on my view of things.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk about housing for just a moment before we return to phone calls. Are people a little more able to sell their houses right now? There was an interesting report yesterday I'd like to have you comment on as well, is that people just aren't moving at right. all long distance, which really changes the nature of the country.
It does, and this is something that's been well known, but typically involved regions as opposed to the entire country. So if we look back in the 1980s, certainly Texas went through an enormous decline in house prices and a really bad recession. We've seen various kinds of problems like this in, you know, California, in New England, Detroit. But the problem here is that it's happening around the country at the same time. And that's why the news is so bleak. I thought they certainly talked about housing, but they're just, you know, there are a lot of people who are stuck in their homes at the moment. They can't sell them, and they're not quite sure what to do. And, you know, what's happened in, I mean, you know, the old, you know, go back to Roger and Me, where you sort of had people in Flint, Michigan who were, you know, faced with the idea that their homes had basically become worthless. Short of housing becoming worthless, and you just deciding I'm leaving Flint, Michigan because there's just nothing here, I think people are stuck in their homes, and the best policies we can make at the moment are going to be to try and spur the housing market to pick up. I think for people who are selling their homes, the Federal Reserve is your biggest friend. I think the caller on the other line was suggesting, gee, we're keeping interest rates artificially low. I think absent the Federal Reserve, the economy would be in a catastrophe at the moment. So I would have given the Federal Reserve an A for their efforts to try and push down mortgage rates, because that is the thing that has helped the housing market even get to where it is now, because they're buying $1.5 trillion of mortgage-backed securities, which is allowing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to make mortgages to people who are going to buy homes. You know, if you have listeners who are putting their home on the market for the spring season, the only reason they can do it is because the Federal Reserve has helped Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac fund their mortgages. And that's been a huge benefit. But it's still, you know, the average down payment the fourth quarter of last year on a home lent to by Fannie Mae was 28% down.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big difference between zero down, which we would all
yes.
agree is a bad idea,
right.
and 28% down, which we would also agree is going to be pretty hard for most Americans to do without a huge adjustment.
Yes. Let's go to Tom from Portage. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good morning, and good morning to your guest. I appreciate the guest straight talk, unvarnished comments that he's been making here, and I hesitate a little bit to add a few of the I did speak to a friend of mine who's a real estate salesperson, experienced, been doing it for 20 plus years. We have a lot that we had purchased a few years ago. I wanted to sell it on speculation. A bad move on my part. He tells me that real estate market probably isn't going to get better for about 5 years. He also told me that 20% nationwide of mortgage holders are 60 days or more behind on payments. And I wanted to get your reaction to that, see if that jives with your numbers. And also, American consumer, implications, I guess, long term.
Right. Well, so I can give you some numbers, the latest numbers that I have. The Mortgage Bankers Association has reported, roughly speaking, about 1 in 10 mortgages is delinquent in some way, shape, or form, meaning at least 30 days delinquent, in the process of foreclosure, or, you know, in some other area where they're not paying. And that has been growing rapidly, and the biggest growth in that has been among prime, high-quality borrowers. So that's just sort of nationwide data. You know, 1 in 10 isn't, you know, 1 in 5, but 1 in 10 is an unprecedented number of mortgages that are in trouble. What we are looking at is more like a third of all mortgages are probably underwater, meaning the house is worth more than the mortgage amount, if you add up with second liens and other things. So we have a really serious problem for many, many people in this country. And I think we have passed the point where now people are deciding, you know what, I'm not necessarily going to pay my mortgage because why am I doing it? So I think we're in trouble there in terms of your lot. I hate to say, but land is the place that takes it on the chin more than anything else. So, if you can hold on to it, and if you haven't got a loan on it, you know, I'd hold on to your land for a while because I think it's going to be quite some time before things turn down. They're probably going down, turn up, and they're probably going down before they go up.
He mentioned 5 years. What do you think?
I'm not, 5 years till, I think the housing market will turn up before 5 years. It will take much longer than 5 years before many markets hit their previous peak. And in some places like, Florida, California, Las Vegas, we could easily be looking at a decade or more before house prices come back to their peak. And that's with a reasonably optimistic scenario for the economy. And, so,
and they could reach a previous peak that was pretty high.
Well, at some point they will. I mean, in the long run, everything eventually becomes more expensive. Haircuts, everything will eventually, get back to where they were before. In places like California, I think the recovery is going to be much quicker, because house prices in California have, on average, gone up 2-3% faster than the rest of the country, and that's been for 50 years. That has nothing to do with the recent boom. In places like Florida and Nevada, not really going to happen. And I think in the Midwest, for the most part, the house price declines have been much less because the boom was much less than around the rest of the country. And so your listeners, while things aren't great, your listeners are probably sitting in pretty close to the best part of the country in terms of not having really suffered the same excesses as other places. And I know that doesn't sound that great, but on a relative basis, this is, your listeners are still in better places to be at the moment than, many other parts of the country in housing.
Let's go next. Thank you, Tom, very much for your call. We go to Laura from New Berlin next. Hi, Laura.
Good morning. I guess I don't buy the guest argument that we need to allow these managers to operate in secrecy without disclosure of salaries, lest they go to the shadow markets and earn higher compensation. I would question what kind of people are these that, if they can't operate without any kind of scrutiny, they're going to go and plunder the country for even more in the shadow markets.
I guess I wouldn't describe what finance people do as plunder on an overall basis. That does not mean that there were not people who did that. But at a very general level, people who are operating in the banking industry are people who are lending money to borrowers who are going to go do lots of things that they do. And that basic banking system and banking model has, you know, is around in all countries and in lots of ways. But I just, I again sort of just ask people to sort of think about, do you want your salary made public? Are you willing to have your salary made public and have somebody go question what you're doing, and if they don't like it, show up on your lawn with posters and billboards? I think most people are not willing to have their salary be public. We certainly know through the census that there's enormous issues associated with confidentiality. And I wouldn't take a job, and I think many Americans wouldn't take a job, where everyone knows your salary, and if they don't like it, they can show up on your lawn and complain with billboards and, you know, other things. And unfortunately, that has happened. And that you're not going to get good people to work under those conditions. I'm not saying, by the way, that I don't think there shouldn't be oversight. I think there should be very strict oversight of what's going on. But I don't think publishing the salaries of people who work for banks is the most productive way to accomplish that oversight.
And your views, Professor Mayer, on the oversight of the past, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, previous years, has there been a complete lack of oversight?
Absolutely. There's been an enormous lack of oversight. And one should not mistake my comments for saying we should just go back to where we were 2 years ago and, you know, just kind of let there be a free-for-all. I think salaries and bonuses got out of whack. They got much too large, and we have to fix that. I just don't think the most effective way of fixing it is publishing salaries. I think we're going to have real regulation, and I think we're going to need accountability from boards of directors all the way down to shareholders. And so I do think we need real reforms to change the system that we're in. I just don't think publishing publicly is going to get us there. And I think if we spend too much time trying to just, you know, telling people that if they make any money at all in doing this, that they're going to be in trouble, we're really just not going to get anyone to participate in these programs. And that seems crazy, but, you know, I'll just, you know, when I wrote my dissertation on real estate auctions in the late 80s, early 90s, in Texas and California. And what the government did was just auctioned off millions of properties at auction. Some of them were 10, 20 cents on the dollar. People bought properties at those auctions and have made very large sums of money by doing it. Anything from individual investors to larger, you know, I'd call them shadow institutions, private equity firms, other things, made lots and lots of money participating in government auctions. And as an economist, I would say that was exactly what we needed. The only way to get people to step in with their own capital, their own money, and participate is to let them have the prospect of doing well if they succeed, because if they don't, they're going to lose their money. And I think we can't just completely go out and say that, you know, that we're just not going to allow that to happen. Because the government, PPIP, with the public-private partnerships, there will be no private partners. And, you know, I think that President Obama has understood that there's a balance between the rhetoric of this and the populist view, again, driven by real underlying problems of how much people are making. Because it's just not, it is fundamentally not going to get us out of this problem, and we should all see the forest for the trees. We all need to get out of this mess. That is the most important thing for everybody who's listening.
Everybody will agree with you on that. We need to get out of this mess. Professor Chris Mayer is our guest, Senior Vice Dean and Paul Milstein Professor of Real Estate Finance and Economics, Columbia University Research Director at the Center for Real Estate at Columbia. And he has testified before the House and Senate on how we get out of this mess. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls for Professor Mayer, and let's go to Tom next. Hello, Tom.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Elizabeth Warren, who was put in a position by Congress as oversight of the TARP program and to figure some things out, she has no answers. She's been able to find out no answers. And, in fact, Hank Paulson lied to her in a letter that she sent when they were starting the original TARP program, what we would get back for our investment in this. And it hasn't been anywhere near that. But Simon Johnson, who's an economist who used to work for the IMF, said you could take the U.S. and just insert another emerging market and put that in the place of the U.S., and all the problems we're having are exactly like some of the emerging market countries, the Eastern Europe countries, everything like that, that the IMF encounters, and we're having the same problems. But so we haven't gotten any more information. This program was touted as, you know, where's the TARP money gone? Well, I haven't heard any answers yet about where the TARP money's gone. It's gone to Goldman Sachs, Citigroup multiple times, all these other countries. I just think it's almost like there's been a coup, and we're being blackmailed and held over a barrel by the financial industry.
So, the first, Goldman Sachs would desperately like to pay its TARP money back. The question is, will Treasury let it? Citigroup basically isn't worth much, and, you know, the value of that money put in is very low. But, again, the question is not, you know, what would we do if we just said, fine, let Citigroup disappear? That's fine. Close them down. Put them in bankruptcy.
And I think
the question is, what is the alternative to...
Well, just one second, Tom. Let's get an answer.
I don't know what the alternative is for Citigroup. I don't like the way we've kept them alive. But the alternative is either nationalization, which whatever you think we've put in so far, if we were to go a nationalization route with Citigroup, which I actually think we're going to eventually do anyway, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars in that bank alone if we were to nationalize them. But the three alternatives are do what we've done, leave them alone and let them fail, or nationalize them. I don't see another alternative.
Well, I appreciate your comments. And one thing for clarification, people need to know this PPIP program that is the public-private partnership program for buying some of these things and valuing them. The taxpayers are essentially, through the agreement, on the hook for 85% of that. So you can get the private equity and the shadow banking back into this. They'll have 15% investment on this. We're still on the hook for 85%, and then depending on what it valued. And then if it fails, we pick up the 85% of the tab.
I could not agree with you more, Tom. I think the PPIP program is terribly designed, and in fact, I think it's even worse than you suggest, which is the government also puts in half of the remaining 15 cents. 50-50 with private equity. So private equity is only putting in 7.5 cents for every dollar they're buying, and they get to keep half the upside. I think PPIP is a terribly designed program. I think most economists would agree. And it's another way that the administration at the moment is taking policies that are trying not to fully, you know, realize the problem. A lot of it is because of the sentiment that you and other callers have expressed, which is that we just don't want to throw more money into this problem, that the banks are doing really bad things. And that has driven public policy to where we are today, but it's driven it towards solutions that are not real solutions. And history tells us, and there's lots of history to back this up, that we really need to fully address problems like these, close down institutions that are in trouble, recapitalize them, and put them back out. It costs taxpayers more money in the short run, but the economy recovers much more quickly. And that's the problem, and we have not been willing to do that up till now. I hope that our policies are turning out to be okay, that the economy will end up growing faster than we think, and things will be better. But, you know, today's unemployment report, new records on, you know, claims for unemployment and number of people continuing to receive unemployment benefits are not helpful in terms of the view that we're going to be able to grow our way out of it without dealing with the banking problems.
Thank you, Tom, very much for the call. What makes you say that you believe eventually Citigroup will be nationalized?
Well, I just think fundamentally, I mean, you know, I don't want to pick on Citigroup alone. I would sort of say several of the large banks are in a position where, you know, they have their assets, which I kind of described earlier, which is the loans they have, are not worth what they're, you know, what they now have them for on their books. And they're going to require additional infusions of government money to fix them. And I think the way we're providing the infusions at the moment is just not a very good system to do it. And so I think we're going to eventually be faced with some kind of government takeover, some way, shape, or form. And currently the government doesn't even have the legal authority to do this with Citi and some of the other bank holding companies. But I do think there's a reasonable chance, not certain, but a reasonable chance that we're going to be forced into taking stronger action, because eventually the losses are going to grow and eventually some of these institutions aren't going to be able to hide.
Let's go to Gene from Colfax. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think the public's getting sold a little bit short on the outrage over these bonuses, because over the years we've been trained that when a company is profitable and you're doing a good job in assisting in making that company profitable, then you get your bonus. I don't think anybody has a problem with somebody that's making money for a company getting a bonus. I think the outrage comes when these companies are putting up record losses, getting money from the taxpayers, and still paying out the bonuses like it's business as usual.
So I don't think they're paying out bonuses as business as usual. Even the worst numbers don't suggest that. But I agree with you. Academics have written for years that you shouldn't just be paying bonuses to people based on sort of, you know, lucky events. So, for example, when the price of oil goes crazy, the CEO of Exxon gets a huge bonus because Exxon made big profits. Academics have long said you should not be rewarding executives for an overall market expansion. And that certainly includes the finance sector. So there's been a lot of writing about this and the problems with this for a long time. So I think the status quo that we had was bad and is one that we need to figure out how to change. But the losses the banks are suffering today are because of past decisions. And what you need for managers is managers who are going to be here today making good decisions for the future. And we won't realize the benefits of their actions for several years. And so what people have been looking at is a better kind of system of bonuses where you receive your bonus in the future based on the results of what you've done today as opposed to getting paid it all today. So that kind of system would be a much better system for rewarding people who do well based on the actions they take today, because you can't see them down the road. So I think that's a reform that we're going to look at seriously and I think accomplish down the road. But I'm not talking about giving people, you know, multi-million dollar bonuses. I think we really need accountability, and I don't think the public is wrong to not want those large bonuses. But we're not seeing even the numbers New York State put forward just does not have that same level. But remember that on Wall Street, you could have somebody that's a very senior executive in a company making a salary of $120,000 a year, and their bonus, based on the way compensation is, could be, you know, $200, $300, $400, $10 million. So the bonus isn't really just a bonus. It's part of what their salary is. And what we should be doing is kind of setting the salaries more in line with where their salary should be and having bonuses that are completely dependent on performance. That's what I'd like to see.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to a quick email. We're almost out of time. It seems to me if a person's salary is so high that he or she doesn't want others in the community to know about it, maybe something's wrong with that level of pay. If you don't want it known, is it a source of shame you're getting away with something that you don't think can stand up to scrutiny?
I don't think I any American that wants can publish their salary if they'd like. I think anybody who wants to can put a, you know, put a sign in the front lawn of what their salary is. I think most Americans value their privacy enormously and don't think that it is the community's business what they're earning or not earning. And by the way, many people are ashamed on the other side of what they're not earning as well as what they are earning. And I think that that is just completely the wrong idea, for it is not the culture that we live in, and publishing everybody's salary is not, I think, a solution to where we are. It's just going to generate more and more outrage and concern and, you know, all of these other problems.
Professor Mayer, thank you so much for the hour. It was a good conversation. Thank
sure.
you.
Very happy to join you, Kathleen. Thank you.
Our pleasure. Our guest, Professor Chris Mayer. He is Senior Vice Dean and Paul Milstein Professor of Real Estate Finance and Economics at Columbia University and Research Director of the Center for Real Estate at Columbia. He's done a great deal of work talking and helping to fashion how to deal with the current financial crisis, and has testified before the House and the Senate on the use of TARP funds and also how to reduce foreclosures. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks everybody for your calls. We'll return following the news.